Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Just a warning, there is reference to pregnancy loss and infertility in this episode, so please take care whilst listening. Hello and welcome to The Midpoint with me, Gabby Logan. TV presenter, journalist and podcaster Anna Richardson is my guest today. Anna is known for excelling at a certain brand of broadcasting, the frank, unflinching kind which take on taboos, shows like Naked Attraction, Love Bites and The Sex Education Show. Anna is also the co-founder of Mindbox, an online therapy centre that specialises in supporting people struggling with stress and anxiety. And this inspired her new podcast, It Can't Just Be Me, which bears her hallmark warmth and candour. Wonderful beauty guru and regular presenter on This Morning, Nadine Baggett is also back with us to talk about what our midlife skin really needs. So without further ado, let's meet Anna. Anna Richardson, thank you so much for joining us on The Midpoint. Look at you. It's the best fringe on television.
Oh, well, I mean, between me, Claudia and Davina, I think we've got fringes covered. Somebody once said on what used to be Twitter, Anna Richardson, Davina McCall and Claudia Winkleman, same person, different font. And I kind of thought, we kind of like borrow the same wig.
No, your hair's amazing. And we'll get to all things aesthetic, I think, a little bit later on, because our expert coming on later is Nadine Baggett, and we have definitely chatted hair before, but yours is looking luscious. But I want to read you something. I'm going to get my glasses for this one. A little quote. I hope this is from you, because I read online that you said this. There's something wonderful about this stage of life. When you come through menopause, it's like you're the wise woman of the village. It opens the door to the second half of your life, a life of freedom, self-knowledge, purpose, and a life no longer worrying about fertility. Do you remember saying that?
Do you know what? I do. And I think it wasn't that long ago, because obviously as a menopausal woman, and you and I have discussed this, there is something very challenging about midlife. So I was looking for the positive in it in terms of menopause and no longer having our fertility. But I absolutely stand by those words. Yeah, I do feel that.
And it struck me as well, the last bit, a life no longer worrying about fertility, because you've been very open about that and you kind of discovered your own fertility issues working on a TV show, didn't you?
Yeah.
And I feel like you've had a rough ride with hormones in your life.
Do you know, I have. It's been very, very difficult for me. I mean, certainly as a teenager, my periods were very challenging. So I've got a lot of those sort of fertility issues in terms of emotional response to my hormones. So my periods were challenging as a teenager. I had an ectopic pregnancy when I was a student, which nearly killed me. And so as a result of that, I became really terrified of pregnancy. And I think that's probably why I've never had my kids, which is a bit of a regret of mine. But then I discovered on TV when I was doing a show for Channel 4, there was I thinking in my mid to late 30s, I've got thousands, millions of eggs, no problem with my fertility. And then I discovered on air that actually it was practically impossible for me to have kids and that I'd completely shot my fertility. So it has been quite a rough ride in terms of, do I want kids? Did I want kids? Oh, and now I can't have kids. Mm. I've got a very, very strange relationship with my fertility and regret around that.
So when you get to the point in your life when everybody is in the same situation, they're no longer able to have children because they get to the point where your body doesn't produce eggs anymore, and that is called the menopause. Does it feel like, okay, now I'm kind of in the place where we're all the same now? Because it's hard, isn't it, because I have my own fertility issues. It's hard when you feel like somehow you're not matching up at the right time to people's expectations. And, you know, as women, we're given all different kinds of hands, aren't we? Dealt different hands to work with. And now we're all the same in a way, you know?
Yes, and I mean, you're absolutely right to say the menopause is an equaliser for sure. And, you know, I have endless conversations with my girlfriends about how many pumps of estrogen are you on? Oh, what, have you tried the pessaries yet? For the project, blah, 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 blah. So it is an equaliser, but at the same time, motherhood isn't, and fertility isn't an equaliser in a way. So I was at a party recently with a lot of kind of local mums and dads, and I still felt acutely aware of the fact that I was the only person in there that didn't have children. Mm. And that all of these friends of mine were talking about their kids leaving to go to uni, or they're now doing work experience with so-and-so. And you are still that woman in the corner going, well, I haven't got the kids to compare with you about this. I haven't got the school anecdotes. But then somebody very kindly stepped in when I was sort of chatting about this at the party and said, yeah, but you know what? You know, back in the day, and maybe this goes back to that quote you just mentioned a second ago about being the wise woman. This woman who was a psychotherapist said, yeah, well, back in the day, you would have been the woman in the village that everybody would have wanted to have talked to, because you would have had the wisdom. It's almost like being, you know, the shaman or the witch of the village, that childless person that actually has the knowledge. So it was quite interesting to be seen.
And do you feel like that? Do you feel like that, that it's given you an insight and some experiences and a prism through which other people don't see life and society?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I suppose when you don't have children, you take the road less travelled in a way. And it is quite a lonely road. It's a road where you are absolutely excluded from most things that most other adults enjoy. So I do have a kind of unique prismatic perspective on life in a different way, maybe. In some ways, it's a privileged position to be able to stand back and look in at what other people are going through. But at the same time, Gabby, I mean, I'll be honest with you, there is a big part of me that regrets not having had a family. And I am actively looking at fostering an adoption, because there's a big part of me that's going, well, I'm 53, I'm still relatively young. I could still offer a child a very loving and stable home. Mm. So it's possible to hold these two conflicting emotions at the same time, I think.
And you kind of wrestle with this, hearing you talk there about the party situation. I feel really bad, because I feel like, have I ever said anything again with somebody around like that? And then you know, and it's how you manage those situations. I think if you're aware of it, I think that's the first step, isn't it? To be aware that not everybody's in the same boat.
100%. It might be helpful sometimes, I think, for people with families, with children, and, you know, people who seem to have the perfect life, in inverted commas, it might be helpful for them perhaps sometimes to stop and wonder whether they've got a woman or a guy within that group that hasn't got their children, and how that might feel for them. It is useful to be aware and to be sensitive towards other people's fertility issues or choices, for sure.
And it does make your midlife experience quite different. We've had other people obviously on the podcast before who haven't got children, and you know, your how midlife feels to you is different, because as you pointed out then, for a lot of people it is the releasing of their children into the world, and suddenly they're kind of, you know, they're dealing with empty nests and all those kinds of things. You're thinking of starting that journey in midlife.
I know, it fills me with fear, and I'm conscious of the fact that, you know, I've got very good friends who are, as you say, releasing their kids to university. And I've sat back and thought about that and putting myself in their shoes and thinking, God, that must be such a period of grief. It must be so weird. I mean, our parents talked about it, and, you know, we never really understood, did we, when we were younger? We were like, what are you on about? But now I look at my friends who are saying goodbye to their firstborn at uni, and I think, God, that must be such a loss in a way. I can understand how difficult that transition might be. But at the same time, I'm going, oh, well, you know, perhaps I want to foster or adopt a child. Have I left it too late? Am I going to be that crazy woman at the school gates that's way too old for this? You know, are other women going to be looking at me going, why are you here? You know, so it does fill me with anxiety.
I think now in 2023, or whenever you're listening to this podcast, I don't think you will be looked at like that, because I feel like now there is such a diverse range of what a parent looks like, you know, whether it's two men together with a child, two women together with a child, a woman on her own, a man on their own, you know, the ages, the average age of having your first child going up every year anyway. So I think if you're a kind, loving person, that's all society wants of parents, isn't it? You know, to be generous and kind and help guide that person through life. That's the best you can do.
Well, yeah, I mean, I hosted a conference recently on, it was called the Modern Family Show, and it was looking at the shape of modern families moving forward. And it was so fascinating because it's run by two gay dads who are married and have had their own kids through surrogacy. And it was so interesting to look at all the people there and the different ways that they were trying to build their family, whether it was through surrogacy, whether it was through IVF, whether it was through adoption or fostering or platonic co-parenting. This is a whole new thing that people are looking into, which I had no idea about, that actually becoming a parent with a really good friend. So you're right to say that, you know, in 2023, it's perfectly possible to create that shape of a family in whichever way you want it to be. And we should embrace that.
Absolutely. And of course, the one thing you need is energy and vim and vigor and all those things. And you've got tons of that. You seem like you really look after yourself. You look great. And you clearly have a lot of energy. What are you doing in that department in terms of the exercise and lifestyle and how that's changed?
Good point. I need to get some of your energy, actually. And definitely I need to increase the energy for sure. I mean, I have found the menopause has really hit me in terms of my energy reserves, I must admit. So I do get quite easily fatigued. I do try and look after myself as much as I can. So I do try and focus on exercising, not as often as you, but I'll try and exercise at least 3 times a week, being outside in fresh air, walking for me. I've got a place in the Peak District. So being outside in the fresh air, walking is very, very important for me. I understand the emphasis on weight training, particularly for middle-aged women at the moment. So I've been looking a lot into that and thinking about changing my diet, because I'm vegetarian, so it's very sort of carb heavy, which I know isn't good for us in the age. I'm trying to focus on changing my diet to be much more protein focused, and that's a challenge at the moment. So I've been reading all about how Bear Grylls kind of sort of, you know, rips up animals, offal and all, and sort of, you know, eats everything.
He was a vegan though before that, wasn't he?
Yes, and he's talked about how much better he feels. I mean, you look at that man's body, he's extraordinary. And he was talking in the papers recently about how he feeds all of his family, you know, the meat and the offal and all the rest of it, of an animal carcass. So I'm sort of trying to get my head around, do I need to go that far given that I'm veggie? Or, you know, are there other ways that I could try and increase my protein and focus on, you know, building strength? I think the other thing about being at this age is the focus on trying not to, or to build your body in a way that you're not going to fall over in 20 years' time. Or if you do fall over, like my parents do all the time,
then you won't break.
You can actually, you can get up off the floor.
Yeah.
So that there's a sort of reshifting, isn't there, when it comes to exercise? But you know all about that.
Yeah, future-proofing, making sure that you, as you say, you're building the body that in your 70s and 80s, you can still do things and look ahead to a fun later life. I think that's what this period seems to be, that resetting seems to be about, actually.
It is a reset. I mean, we focus so much on being thin, and particularly with the shows that I've done throughout my career, which are very, very body focused. And there's been such an emphasis, and still is, on trying to be slim as possible. And that's actually, especially in your middle age, not necessarily healthy.
No, it's not necessarily healthy. And also, it can actually age you a lot if you're too thin, I think. And it's having muscle and good bone density, I think, is probably the two key things that we need to think about. But also, keeping the cardio going as well, and the strength. So
I think you're right. There's certainly a focus on trying to have a healthy body rather than trying to have a thin body.
Let's talk about this career of yours, as you've brought it up, in terms of you have had a lot of body and kind of sex related shows have been across your roster, let's say. Of course, Naked Education, Naked Attraction. When did that first, because obviously you are the go-to person, right? Because people go, well, Anna Richardson, she's got very liberal, she's very relaxed talking about sex and sexuality. She's the one to go to. But was it always that way?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I've got quite an interesting career in that I've done every side of the camera. So I started off in production, started off on Big Breakfast as a researcher on that with the greats, Chris Evans and Gabby Roslin. And then I flip-flopped in front of the camera purely by fluke and then came back behind the camera to run development, actually, which is when you come up with all the formats that we then see on TV, which I love doing that. creative process of deciding what shows people are going to end up watching. And I guess the first big show that I developed was You Are What You Eat with Gillian McKeith. So we're talking probably 20 years ago now. So I suppose that sort of, you know, put the stake in the ground in terms of my interest in bodies, nutrition, health, and also quite taboo subjects. Because if you remember, Gillian was just obsessed with looking at people's poo. Mm. So in a way, I guess that probably started that interest. And then I just sort of got associated with bodies. And it's like a sort of snowball. It just gathers moss and, you know, continues and becomes bigger.
Your brilliant style of presenting on Naked Attraction, anybody who didn't know anything about your previous life, or, you know, they, you know, an alien who just come down to watch that show, would think this is a woman who is incredibly relaxed with, you know, bodies, nudity, sex. And I wonder if it was always thus, you know, were you that kind of child, that kind of teenager?
Yes. I mean, funnily enough, you and I touched on this last week when you popped on to the podcast that I was doing. But I grew up in a vicarage. My father is a priest. My mother's an RE teacher. So as a little girl,
they are the natural producers of somebody who presents Naked Attraction. I mean,
well, the thing is, you say that. Yes, they are. Yes, they are. Because if you think about what a priest, what a vicar does, you know, they are in the pulpit and they are broadcasting to a community, to an audience. So I learned a lot of my skills from my dad in terms of being at ease in front of an audience. And then and the same with the teacher, you know, you do the same thing. You're broadcasting in front of a classroom.
Oh yeah, I get that, but it's the sex bit though.
Well, okay. So the vicarage was very, very open. Hmm. So we would have all kinds of people coming through the door every day, you know, whether it was a bishop or a beggar. And I think maybe the sex thing was because it was a very tightly controlled environment. You're talking about the church here. I think I had that natural rebellion in me, which was, okay, you know, if we're not going to talk about these taboo topics, then I'm the only girl in the family. I'm going to be the one that's going to buck that trend. And I'm not afraid to discuss this. And because I think that there was something about being brought up in the 70s and the 80s, especially in a very patriarchal, you know, church environment, that you shouldn't talk about that. Girls don't talk about this. So I think I probably just thought, well, F you, I'm going to do what I want.
Because they'd given you that example of confidence and communication anyway. So it's kind of their fault for making you so open. And then you go, right, well, now I'm going to talk about what I want to talk about. And they're going, oh, hang on.
Look, that's what I like to remind them. It's your fault. Yeah. But do you know what? It's so funny, isn't it? That parents, I love my parents, but it's really interesting how parents take the credit for all of your successes. So I saw them recently. I said, oh, you know, I've just been put up for an award, or there's a piece in the papers about me this weekend. And both of them sat there and went, didn't we do a good job? Didn't we do a good job to each other? That's all about us.
Yeah, but the best is when kind of parents, they then kind of somehow repel or disown the negatives, you know, the things that aren't them, you know. So, yeah. Well, I didn't give you that, actually. That's not from me. That's from your
father.
They
want the glory. They absolutely want the glory. And then they don't want anything to do with the negative sides of your personality, for sure.
So those kinds of shows, which are a lot more prevalent, I'd say, in the last 10, 15 years than they were on our screens, because everything's a little bit more open, isn't it? We wouldn't have seen those kinds of shows probably in the 1970s and 80s. Do you think they've changed our society? Have we got a better attitude towards sex, do you think, because of that openness?
What shows like Naked Attraction? That's really interesting, actually, Gabby. I think it's a confluence, if you think about it, that in a way we're reflecting back, we're holding a mirror up to society, and at the same time that influences society, I think. I think more than anything, probably pornography and social media has had an effect on the kinds of shows that we're producing and how comfortable people are talking about sex.
Access to pornography is greater and easier than it ever has been because of social media. And you think therefore then people's appetite for those kinds of programs is greater, or they just expect to see more of that kind of thing?
I mean, think about it. You know, pornography is just accessible on every single device. We've then got the proliferation of social media, where also you can access pornography, you know, whenever you want. And we're broadcasting our own pornography. So I just think that in that sea of acceptance around sex and bodies, that people are very, very comfortable more than ever, I think, talking about sex or experiencing sex. So I think we're just, with Naked Attraction or Naked Education, just reflecting back what's going on in society. And that's not necessarily a good thing, by the way. No. I'm very proud of the fact that I'm part of that conversation of acceptance, but it does worry me. A few years ago, I did something called Sex Education versus Pornography. And this was about 15 years ago, where we were talking about the the proliferation of pornography and how it's affecting kids at school, and, you know, how it's not monitored, how this is a bad thing. And here we are 15 years later with exactly the same thing going on, exactly the same conversation. So it's not necessarily a good thing.
No, and I know, you know, a lot of people I know with younger children, say kind of a 12, 13, 14, getting their first phones, and then they have access to all kinds of content. Even if you put blocks on it, obviously somebody can send them something on Snapchat or WhatsApp and they can see things. And that kind of almost being anaesthetized to things that we would be horrified that young people were seeing. And I just find that so worrying. You know.
Do you know, I don't know that they are anaesthetized. I think that they are hugely affected by seeing the very violent images that are available.
I suppose that was the wrong word. Maybe what I mean is that it becomes so normal for them to see those things.
Yes, it's normalized. You're right. But I think the effect that it has on young psychology is deeply, deeply troubling. I think I read a stat somewhere the other day that kids now, the average age of kids being able to get hold of porn is something ridiculous, like 9 years old. And you know, it is a real concern. And then, of course, we're breeding a whole generation of boys who think it's perfectly normal to want to choke a girl when they're having, they think that that's what loving sex is. So, you know, we've got a generation coming up behind us of kids with a very dysfunctional view of what healthy sex and relationships looks like.
So it is a bit of a paradox, isn't it? On the one hand, that you can have a show like Naked Attraction where, you know, you're revealing people's genitals, you know, as the curtain moves up, and you'd feel like, oh, that's a very liberal society with, you know, healthy approach to their bodies. And then on the other hand, as you say, this really distorted idea of what sexual relationships are for young people who are being exposed to pornography.
Yes, but you're right. Although the difference with Naked Attraction, and I defend Naked Attraction, you know, to the hilt, because there's nothing pornographic about Naked Attraction. There's nothing sexy about it. There's nothing pornographic. No one's going to tune in and think, oh, this is really sexy. Not at all. It's funny, number one. It's a game, number two. But when you go below both of those layers, it's actually about acceptance. And it's about education. So I'm very proud of the fact that we reveal nakedness in all its forms. You never see this sort of sea of people with perfect bodies. We reflect people with perfectly ordinary, average, normal bodies. And we talk about the differences in those bodies and what people like and what they don't like. And there's nothing sexy about it at all. It's really about saying, this is what I look like with my kit off. Love me and accept me. So I'm deeply proud of the fact that with some of the contributors that we've had on there, we've got people with disabilities, we've got trans people who are going through their journey, we've had people on there who are HIV positive. You know, it's a whole reflection of society.
That's what I mean, though, in terms of the paradox, because that is a very, you know, as you say, accepting. And then on the other hand, feels like we still haven't kind of worked out as a society how to have honest conversations about sex and healthy conversations.
100%. And to this day, I have sort of various punch-ups with people in television when I bring this topic up. But to this day, I've never watched a single episode of Love Island. Because for me, Love Island is, you know, I find it troubling, and it is the antithesis, in a sense, of what we're trying to do on Naked Attraction. So, you know, for me, this is about perfection. It's about betrayal. It's about youth. It's about people trying to, you know, manipulate and maneuver their way into getting what they want. So, I worry more about formats like that in terms of educating younger people, because I think it's giving some really,
it's totally
ropey,
unrealistic,
really ropey morals and ethics.
Yeah, and it's just not it's not real at all, is it, in terms of what, you know, what relationships end up being about and how, although is it that now the reality for young people that they're, you know, you see it all the time, don't you, when people are kind of catfishing almost, how they're projecting themselves on their social media and what they're able to create, which is not like the reality. And then that must affect your self-esteem, you know, as a person, mustn't it?
Totally. So there is something about with the program that we do, there's something about getting real, you know, that if you are working in television and you're on TV, and especially if you've got a good producer's brain or you understand how, you know, formats work, I think there is a degree of responsibility in terms of trying, especially for young people watching, trying to educate or inform as best a way you can.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
And it also leans into a little bit your work away from telly in terms of mental health and dealing with anxiety, Mindbox, and your qualification as a cognitive hypnotherapist.
Yeah, I know, it's difficult to say, isn't it?
Yeah. And you went into that area because of your own experiences.
Yeah.
With the view to working in that space full time, was that the initial idea?
It's a good hat to be able to wear. And in terms of being able to have an alternative career, should I wish to have one, or to juggle both in a way. So, I mean, I guess with a lot of the shows that I've done in television, they've always had that sort of helping element to them, or there's a transformational element. So I think my interest in mental health is part and parcel of that. And again, the way that I was brought up in a vicarage, it's about helping other people. So it's kind of in my DNA. But yeah, I do wear a therapy hat with a view to possibly in later life having my own practice or wanting to expand that in some way. So I've qualified as a cognitive hypnotherapist. I have an online platform called Mindbox, which helps people with anxiety and depression. And I'm qualifying at the moment in my counselling qualification. So I'm just starting to do that as well, which is a challenge, learning again in midlife. But yeah, no, I'm very interested in mental health.
Tell us about the challenge of learning again, because we talk about it a lot and it probably sounds a lot easier than it is, saying, sign up, do a course, challenge yourself, push yourself.
And we do say that, don't we? Whether it's physically or mentally, we do say to people, yeah, you know, don't be afraid, just challenge yourself, as you say. So I've signed up to do my qualification. And I suppose many of us will start with that arrogance, I suppose, of going, I've got a degree, I've got a postgrad, I've done my qualification in cog here, but I know what I'm doing. This is easy, I can do this. So I've signed up and suddenly I'm like, Christ, this is really hard. It's really, really difficult to sort of take yourself back to your university years and remember how you write essays or how you reference things and, you know, doing all of that academic reading. It's actually really difficult. So all this morning I spent hours reading up and trying to answer some questions. And it is a challenge, but essential in terms of, you know, in keeping your brain healthy, expanding your horizons. I love learning. Maybe it's because my mum's a teacher, but I love learning. So I'll do it for the rest of my life, for sure.
Have you found that you are kind of able to, have you got the kind of focus to do a 2-3 hour stint, or are you working in 45 minute chunks? You know, if somebody's listening to this and they're experiencing similar problems getting going, what would you recommend?
I think you just have to do it. And as one of my old teachers said, you've got to approach the elephant one bite at a time. So, you know, you've got this huge thing in front of you. You just have to sit down, focus, and start biting at the elephant. I don't tend to do very short little chunks. I know that my ex, Sue Perkins, always talks about how she will sit and write for 20 minutes and then she's distracted and she needs to go and do something else for 20 minutes. I can focus for about 2 or 3 hours and I like to really get very, very involved in it and then leave it. So that's just how I choose to learn, and that's how I choose.
And you test yourself later to make sure it's gone in, or when you go back to it the next time, do you?
Well, it's funny that you should say that, because about 3 or 4 years ago, I did a show for Channel 4 called Can I Improve My Memory? And so I was a contestant on this sort of memory challenge show, which I absolutely loved. And I learned some techniques with a sort of brain guy in terms of retaining information. So when it comes to doing this counselling qualification, no, I'm kind of focused on just getting the answers right. But I do know what techniques I need to use if I did need to.
Anything you can share?
Yeah, there's something called the memory palace, where if you've got to remember like huge swathes of text, for example, if you're doing a speech, then attach small chunks of that text to different objects around your room, if that makes sense. So that you would start, if you came into your room and you attach the first intro, say, to the lamp in the corner, and then you'd attach the next paragraph to the chandelier on the ceiling. And they're just visual cues in order to help your brain to break up the text and to memorize things more easily. So it's called the Memory Palace. It really, really, really works. And I love doing that show. I absolutely loved it. I got through to the semi-finals. I was delighted.
But memory is one of the, as you know, one of the things, brain fog, that midlife women obviously know that they're in perimenopause, because that's one of the, or it can be one of the reasons they know they're in it, because of the symptoms that we find ourselves struggling to remember names, or struggling to remember that word. What is it again? Oh, book. Yes. Yeah. And that, you know, can be very frustrating, especially if you've had a really elastic kind of, you know, mind and a really good memory, or you've been able to kind of, you know, reel off text and things like that. So I think any of those kind of tips are very, very good. I don't want to go into detail massively about the Schwarzenegger stuff, but it did occur to me. It was interesting because I've heard you talk about, brilliantly talk about it a lot, the legal action that you were involved in with him and his aides, and which you then received damages for defamation. And it struck me, you said, I think afterwards, that you felt you were blacklisted for a while from telly. I've struck me that that was in the kind of 2004, 2005 period, I think, wasn't it? So we're coming up to almost 20 years ago. And I feel like we have progressed, because I feel like that wouldn't happen. You wouldn't be blacklisted now. And I say that because of what's happened with Catherine Ryan talking openly about somebody in her industry who she describes as a dangerous comedian in terms of his behaviour with women. And I feel like she is not being blacklisted when she's talked about this rightly. And you did receive treatment that was negative to your career and hampered your progress. And in many ways, you know, it makes you even, I look back and think you were so brave to do that, because actually you did it in a climate that wasn't ready to have honest conversations. Do you feel we've moved on? And is that, am I maybe clutching at straws with that example, that we have moved on in terms of the openness of those conversations?
It's really interesting that you mentioned that, because with everything that's come out recently about various other sort of, you know, accusations and all the rest of it, I feel as though we're no further forward than we were 20 years ago. We're still experiencing this Me Too movement that we experienced 20 years ago. Nothing really has changed, other than perhaps you're right that perhaps there's a slightly more warm reception if women come forward and sort of do the j'accuse. Although I still feel that behind closed doors, any woman that comes forward and has the courage to speak out, she's always going to be tarred as being difficult or a troublemaker. And people may say that you're not going to be blacklisted, but I think that, you know, shit sticks. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how much further forward.
And maybe because she's not obviously naming names, but maybe because her career is so established, you know, she's perhaps reached a point where she feels she can't be pulled back from, you know, the levels of size of arenas that she's, you know, she does her comedy to, and all of that. But yeah, that's depressing then, isn't it?
If we haven't moved on in 20 years. we are having more of a conversation, but I'm just not sure. I think that we're still very, very nervous about naming people who have behaved, who've behaved badly. I think that we want to talk about it, but I think that a lot of women are too afraid to still.
And at the time, back when you did speak up, did you feel you were in a place where it was going to be okay to speak up? Or did you
Absolutely not.
Yeah, no, right. So you knew there was going to be risk in doing that.
Absolutely. But I felt completely, I mean, you've got to bear in mind that I was effectively taking on one of the biggest stars in Hollywood and his machine. So I was really, really anxious and worried about the whole thing. And I wasn't sure where it was going to go at all, but I just felt compelled to speak my truth and to be able to say, no, this happened. This happened. You can't just pretend that it didn't, or that I'm a liar, or I've made this up. So for me, that kind of justice is extremely important. And it's extremely important that women are vocal about any kind of injustice like that. Absolutely. But I wasn't sure that we were going to settle or that it was going to go my way. It was a very, very anxious time. It took me three years to
reach that. It must have been really stressful.
It was horrific. I mean, fortunately, I had a sort of ace legal team, which included David Sherborne, who, of course, has gone on, you know, to represent Harry and Meghan. And he did the Agatha Christie case. And, you know, he's right up there now. So he was an amazing barrister. And, you know, so I had a really, really good legal team. So I felt very secure with them. But in terms of, I guess, my employment and society, I wasn't confident at all that everything was going to be okay. And for a long time, I was signing on in Kilburn. I mean, I lost my job in television and I was literally going to the job centre and signing on and going, you know, have you got any work? I work in broadcasting. I know that's not going to be on the boards, but, you know, can I just pick up my income support? So it was bad.
It's a saying, obviously, that's well trod, but does it feel like what doesn't kill you makes you stronger? When you look back now, do you feel like it gave you an armoury and a fortitude that you wouldn't have otherwise had?
I think I've always had the armoury and the fortitude. I've always been quite unafraid to speak truth to power. And that has got me into an awful lot of trouble. I refer you back to the fact that if you are a woman and you're a bit of a gobshite and you're prepared to say, actually, no, that's not okay, then you will be labelled as being difficult or a troublemaker, whereas guys will be kind of like heralded as, God, they're so amazing, aren't they? They're such a sort of, you know, maverick. So I've always been unafraid to do that, but it's been a difficult journey to be able to, yeah, to speak truth to power and to survive in this business.
But then I think you're an inspiration as well. So don't forget that, you know, that a lot of women will have taken great strength from that. And I'm sure people have told you that, you know, and told you their own personal experiences. And I hope that has given you some, if not comfort, some sense that you did the right thing.
Without question, I know I did the right thing. And if it inspires or has inspired anybody, then my job's done. I will always say to people that have experienced any kind of injustice that, you know, you have to fight this. You've got to be able to have your right to reply and answer it. So, yeah, I'll always be a gobshite.
I think that's the wrong expression for what you are. That sounds like you're speaking a load of nonsense. But you speak as you say, truth to power, and you do it eloquently, and people listen. That's the thing as well, because you have a platform, don't you, which you use brilliantly. I want to talk a little bit about something much more shallow, visual appearance of aging, and how you kind of, you look great, your hair looks shiny and glossy, your skin looks lovely. So you're obviously looking after yourself well.
Yes. So, I mean, again, you must know this as well. You're on TV, so it's important for me to want to try and look my best. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot in terms of looking after my skin, in terms of looking after my hair as well. Obviously, I mean, I'm completely white. If I let my roots grow out, then, you know, it would just be horrific. I'd look like Santa. But no, I do look after my skin, look after my hair for sure. And for me, it's important. Mm. I completely understand why there are plenty. I've got mates who are like, oh, for God's sake, stop doing the Botox, stop dyeing your hair. For me, it's just part of who I am.
I think it's also, I think, like you say, when you work in telly, and it's not so much that you feel like you want to look younger or you're worried about kind of, you know, people coming up through the industry. I've always felt, and even I felt this in my 20s and 30s, that I'm going into somebody's living room And I want to, you know, put my best shoes on, my best frock, and make sure they feel like I've dressed up for them, or I've, you know, made an effort for them. I don't like I'm just about to empty the dishwasher. That's kind of what my motivation has always been, to look at the best I can, really.
That's a really, really lovely way of describing it. You're absolutely right that if you were going round to somebody's for dinner, then you want to look your best. So, yeah, that's...
You're kind of paying them respect, aren't you?
Completely agree with you on that. I think it's just, it's showing your self-respect, and I think it's showing up other people that you also, you do care about the job that you do. Yeah.
And as you say, not everybody feels the same way, but I also feel better. It makes me feel better. And I don't think it's vanity. I think it's about just trying to feel the best that you can when you open that door and you go out into a difficult world.
It's a form of self-care, isn't it? Mm. It's a form of sort of self-soothing, self-care is to, if you look well on the outside, then you're showing that you respect yourself, I think.
And as somebody who I don't think is going to disagree with us is beauty expert extraordinaire Nadine Baggett, who is our expert today. I know you two have a long-standing relationship, a mutual appreciation of each other. You've worked together in the past. Say hello.
Hello, Nadine. I've not seen you for ages. It's so good to see you. And can I say, I mean, skin like porcelain. You look like a statue.
I can't believe it's been 10 years, Anna. I really can't believe it. It's gone so quickly.
Always great to have you on The Midpoint. I gave you a little bit of homework ahead of today.
You did.
Nadine. As usual, it's always kind of self-serving because I always think, what do I need at the moment? I thought neck. Neck is the thing that I'm, especially when you start wearing your polo necks again and you notice a little bit of skin that's just sticking. No, that one's a kind of nice baggy one. But you know when you wear a slightly tighter one, you think, what's going on here then with the neck? So I was wondering to myself, are neck creams really worth it? That is what I was thinking, Nadine. And then we can apply that to also kind of under the eye and various other areas that they decide they want to manufacture new creams for. But let's start with the neck and the décolletage.
So I wrote a piece for The Times recently, and it was sort of my 36 all-time favourite products. And I got to number 13 and I said, best ever neck cream. Just kidding, you don't need one. There is no reason why you would use a separate product on your neck, because why is the skin under your neck any different than the skin on the rest of your face? So I think neck creams are a marketing con, but that doesn't mean to say you shouldn't look after your neck. And if I could say one thing to my younger self that's really superficial is take your SPF right the way down onto your chest, because this will age differently to this, because we tend to forget this. We tend to put our makeup and our skincare and our SPF down to here, and then we forget our neck and chest.
Down to the jawline.
And then we forget the rest of it.
So the moisturiser that we're using on our face, you think quite happily just take that all down?
Everything. You don't need a specific formulation, so every single thing you put on your face needs to go right down almost to the nipples.
Oh,
it really does. Anywhere that is
exposed. And they could be anywhere, ladies and gentlemen.
We've been through the menopause. We could be down to our ankles by the time we finish moisturising.
So if that's the neck, are there any areas of the face or the upper body that you would say need a special cream or formula?
I would say 90% of the time an eye cream is not needed at all, because the thing that changed in terms of cosmetic formulations to change that is the introduction of serums. Because the minute we introduced serums, which essentially 20 years ago we wouldn't know what they were, but now everybody tends to use a serum, most serums can be used up around the eyes. You just can't use a heavy moisturizer around your eyes. I say there are probably a couple of ingredients that you would use around your eye that you wouldn't wear anywhere else, and that's caffeine. If you do any early morning TV or you've had a late night, caffeine can help boost circulation and it can help
caffeine
drain.
Creams.
Yeah, caffeine eye creams. You don't have to spend a lot of money on them. The Inkeylist do one, Charlotte Tilbury does one, everybody tends to do one nowadays. They just have this ability to sort of constrict the blood vessels and put the lymph back out. So they basically get rid of morning
face. So it's a short term.
It's always a short-term fix. Mm. Always a short-term fix. But you know, the number one question I get asked, probably post-menopause, is what can I do with my neck? It's that moment here. You just do that thing where you pull the back of your jaw up to see what you'd look like if you had a facelift. Yeah. And we've all done it. Look, we're literally, all three of us are doing it now.
You do it when you're in the traffic lights, don't you, in the car sometimes. You just have a little...
Especially if you're in a hotel and lit from above and you suddenly think, what on earth has happened to me? I've aged overnight.
Gabby's got a really very tight
good jawline.
You've got a great jawline.
Well, that's very kind of you.
That was the question I was going to ask you, Nadine, because mine's just gone. I used to be like that. And now, look at that. What can you do?
It's I hate to say this, Anna, but it is inevitable. And I'm 10 years older than both of you, but it is that moment. Now, you see the shape of Gabby's face. She's got quite a large, firm jaw. And that age is better than a slimmer face. You've got a sweet little heart face. And it does tend to age more around here. I'm telling you, there is not a treatment or a product alive. It's the reason that Madonna's gone under the knife. It just is. It's not a secret. I'm sorry, but you know, she might deny it. But if you see any actress or public figure in the public eye and they've got a Gabby jawline and they're older than Gabby, the chances are they've gone under the knife. So to get that, you're essentially having to take, and here I'm doing the classic
what
two
about,
fingers
like,
on
facial
the jawline.
Massage, like the Euphrasia stuff, just keep doing that?
No. So that will help puffiness, and it will help blood flow. But the sagging of the face is actually caused by some fundamentally basic physiological changes that go on. When you go through the menopause, not only do you use collagen and elastin that we all know about, so the skin loses its elasticity, but the skull shrinks. Your face actually shrinks, your cheekbones shrink, your jaw shrink. Now, Anna, you were talking about earlier on about future-proofing and how one day, if you fall over, you do not want to break a bone. Well, you do lose bone density as you get older, and it tends to be hormone driven, and faces tend to shrink. So you lose bone mass. And if you lose bone mass, the skin ends up being a size too large.
So basically your scaffolding is getting smaller.
That's exactly and you, what it
but,
is,
but
Gabby.
Your soft furnishings are the same.
I'm getting
so yes, imagine
you've
like
got a
sofa.
Lovely, you've got a lovely duvet, but you need a new mattress.
Do you know what? I mean, Anna, I didn't expect it to take a turn like it has. I was hoping we were going to be told about a magic neck cream. We'd all go off
Sadly
skipping into
not.
The... And now we're being told our skulls are shrinking. I mean, it's...
I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but it's very interesting. If you look at the way men age, it tends to be a slow, steady decline
because
there are no hormonal fluctuations. Mm. Women tend to age at certain key points in their life, and it tends to be when you have a child, when you're very young, and you've been through a hormonal roller coaster of having a baby and you're sleep deprived. And then the next big leap is the menopause, and it's not the perimenopause, it's the 10 years from 50 to 60.
Oh, God.
Sorry, ladies.
So, what do you do? Are you on HRT, number
one? Absolutely. I started my YouTube channel when I was 54. I remember chatting to Gabby about this. There's no way I would have been doing that. And you are thinking about entering a new life phase at around your early 50s. So you would not even be considering, I suspect, fostering or adopting if you weren't on HRT, because HRT is, for me, it was a life changer for me when I went through my early 50s and I suddenly realized that I was at the peak of my career. I didn't want to lose it. I was on television and I was working for the Times and having this incredibly energetic life. I needed to be on HRT. I couldn't be up 12 times a night having hot flushes. I just couldn't.
Nadine, what are you? I mean, I read your column every week in the Times, or every time that you write it anyway in the Times. And you know, I know you recommend great products for a range of different things and ages. You know, you're not just writing to the menopausal or midlife woman. What's the most exciting thing that you've come across in the last month or so?
Very good question. Probably the most exciting ingredient for all of us who are going through either perimenopause or menopause is the next generation retinol, which is called Retinal. And what it is, so retinol is a vitamin A, your skin uses it, it's a gold standard, you can get it on prescription for acne and for sun damage and things like that. Now, available over the counter is a molecule called retinol, but your body, your skin has to convert it, and it has to convert it two stages so it can become retinoic acid, which is the active form. Retinal is only one stage of conversion, so it's less irritating and more potent, and it's becoming available on the high street. And traditionally, you would have had to pay hundreds of pounds for it. Now it's available and it's beginning to trickle down on the high street. That's very exciting.
Guess what we'll be Googling as soon as we say goodbye on this podcast?
I can say two things. So traditionally, it was Medicaid and it was super high-end and very expensive, but now Aven and a company called Geek and Gorgeous do it, and that's at three different price points. Geek and Gorgeous is high street, Aven is middle, and Medicaid is high-end.
Well, there you go. And we'll make sure that we put all that information in the description of this episode. Because what happens when Nadine's on, Anna, is that I get loads of people DMing me going, what did she say? And I feel like, go back and listen to her again.
Listen, I don't know.
Well, make sure we write it all down. Nadine, as always, absolutely gorgeous to have you on. And thank you for being a ray of beauty, sunshine, and also a role model, I think, for all of us in terms of the next 8-10 years. She looks marvellous, doesn't she?
Can I just say, my absolute pleasure. And Anna, you were absolutely fascinating. I loved every second of this. You are truly an inspiration for all of us. You are.
That is very, very kind, Nadine. It's so good to see you.
Lots of love. Bye.
Oh, it's lovely when I bring an expert on who's been on the podcast before and you know each other. That was great to reunite you.
It's so good to see her. I can't believe that she's 10 years older than we are.
I know. She looks amazing, doesn't she?
She's extraordinary.
I mean, she does spend her days trying out beauty products for all of us. So that's, I mean, there has to be some payback for that, doesn't
there? That is true. I mean, if she looked awful, then clearly they ain't working.
No, the columns. What are these things you're writing about? I know, she's great, Nadine, and she's no nonsense. And I always feel as well that she's not aligned to one brand. You know, she's really fair as well. So Anna, there's lots of exciting stuff coming up for you on the horizon in terms of what you're doing, in terms of your study. And, you know, you've got this inquisitive mind, which I think we don't always appreciate is one of the most important things in terms of successful aging. You know, if you look at the blue zones, it's all about inquisitiveness and keeping yourself active mentally as well, whether that's formal learning like you're doing or just being interested in life. And that is something that shines through you.
Well, thank you. I mean, yeah, I am interested. I'm interested in people. I'm interested in life. I'm interested in learning. I love my job as a broadcaster because the privilege is that we get to meet different people every single day. My podcast, I get to meet different people. And
I love being on your podcast. It's very, very interesting. I love the format.
They're great, aren't they, podcasts? Mm. I really enjoy doing that. So it can't just be me, keeps me interested. I'm also on Steph's Pat Lunch every week doing their agony and relationship.
Well, I was going to say to you earlier on, I think you need your own show as an agony aunt, because I'm feeling like all of this cognitive hypnotherapy and your counselling and all your experiences make you absolutely perfect as an agony aunt.
It would be fun, wouldn't it? I mean, that would be the dream.
There is a gap in the market, I feel. We haven't had that national treasure of an agony aunt for a while now. There was Denise obviously on this morning.
Denise Robertson.
Yeah, and that's one we probably grew up with Denise. But there were, you know, various TV iterations. But I feel like we're missing somebody. And Anna, I think that's you.
That would be amazing. That's the dream. Let's put it out there.
Yeah, manifest
it. That's what we need. We need to manifest a good old-fashioned daytime agony show.
People have got a lot of problems.
Including us. Absolutely.
First letter from me. Anna, thank you so, so much for coming on, being so open and brilliant, and best of luck with all the things you're doing. And do come back and let us know if anything happens regarding the fostering and adopting, because I think a lot of people listening as well will be interested in that journey and how challenging it is at this age and whether it poses extra challenges.
Yeah. Gabby, thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I'm always conscious of the fact when you talk about yourself, I'm always conscious of, is this really boring? So I do hope if anybody is listening and anything's resonated, I would love to know and I'd love to hear.
Well, Anna is anything but boring, I think you'll agree. And thank you to her for bringing her usual honesty and wit to our chat. And I do take my hat off to her for going back to study in midlife and being so honest about the challenges that she's facing there. And Nadine is a fountain of knowledge. You can visit Nadine Baggett's YouTube channel for more, as she puts it, beauty without the BS. Do hit follow wherever you listen to this podcast so you never miss an episode. Thanks again to Anna and Nadine, to Spiritland Productions, and to you for keeping me company. I hope you can join me next week. Bye-bye for now.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.